It is almost scary to realize how quickly Israelis readjust to a reignited war. Saturday morning, sirens off. No surprise. Saturday night, sirens disrupt sleep. As expected, Sunday night, no sirens in Tel Aviv, from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. a full night's sleep. And after less than 48 hours of war, it already feels awkward to get the whole night undisrupted. What is the goal of the war launched by the U.S. and Israel on Iran last week? President Trump has framed it several times, each time through a different lens. In one instance, he spoke of a Persian people that must be liberated. In another, he focused on the missile threat to the U.S. homeland. In a third, he highlighted Iran's relentless pursuit of nuclear weapons. Notably, an issue where American public support for a strike reaches a decent share of approval. PM Netanyahu, too, in his brief Saturday night address to the nation, remained somewhat vague about the finish line. He defined the mission as an operation to remove the existential threat posed by the terror regime in Iran, intended to prevent a murderous regime from arming itself with nuclear weapons that would allow it to threaten all of humanity. It is an operation, Netanyahu claimed, that will create the conditions for the brave Iranian people to take their fate into their own hands. We should sharpen the focus on these goals, because behind them lie several assumptions that don't necessarily sit well together. But let's postpone that discussion for later. Let's begin with the grand idea of grand change. Regime change. In 732 BCE, a great power brought about regime change in the Kingdom of Israel. Tiglath-Pileser III, the Assyrian ruler, grew weary of the rebellious King Pekah son of Remaliah and ensured he was replaced by Hoshea son of Elah. How exactly did this happen? The biblical source teaches that Hoshea murdered Pekah, while the Assyrian source emphasizes that the initiative was Tiglath-Pileser's. Either way, the regime change did not benefit the Assyrians or the Israelites. A few years after the leadership swap, the Assyrians were forced to return, perhaps twice. Shalmaneser, and after him Sargon, fought in Samaria and exiled the tribes of Israel to a diaspora from which they never returned. There is no lesson for our time in this story except for one. Regime change can be a change for the better, or a change for the worse. One can replace a king to find that his successor properly adapts to a new reality, or one might find the successor is more stubborn or more dangerous than his predecessor. What was true for the Kingdom of Israel in the 8th century BCE is true for the Kingdom of Iran in the 21st century CE. The death of Iran's supreme leader Ali Khamenei, he was targeted in the opening salvo of the war, is merely a prelude to the rise of a successor who may be better or worse, more adaptable or more stubborn, more submissive or more rebellious. One can hope that Iran will quickly become a modern, Western-leaning democracy. But one must remember that this is not always the result of regime change. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it is the opposite. The title of the new book by Jonathan Turley, a legal scholar from George Washington University, reveals its content, Rage and the Republic. It focuses on the American Revolution against the British, and it deals with the French Revolution against the monarchy. Neither revolution was driven by an external move for regime change. Both were driven by an internal dynamic. Both percolated on a similar background of public rage against the rulers. The distant British king in the case of the American colonies, and the nearby king in the palace in the case of the French. The revolution did not devour its children. It led the Americans to build republican institutions and a nation with a democratic foundation. It led the French initially to terror, then to Napoleon, and then to the return of the monarchy. The institutions of democracy only came many years later. Turley examines what caused this difference, and his answer focuses on the wisdom of the American founders, who channeled the revolutionary rage, without which regime change would never materialize, into the establishment of solid institutions. Rage is the component required to destroy the old, taming it, channeling it toward constructive goals, is the move to build the new. The Americans were enraged and then sat down to establish institutions. The French were enraged and continued to be enraged, turning their revolution to catastrophe. What will the Iranians do when the smoke clears and the bombers return to their hangars or aircraft carriers? As Israel is learning in Gaza, even if it is convenient for them to forget about it now, and concentrate on a more promising arena, achieving regime change from the outside, without a commitment to deep and continuous involvement, is a difficult task. Sometimes it turns out the enemy does not surrender, the public does not rebel, or the price of change is too high, and this necessitates a decision to either withdraw or invest. The Romans went to the Jugurthine War to depose one African ruler and appoint another. In other words, to bring about regime change. They succeeded, but it took them about 8 years. To achieve the desired result, the Romans had to conquer Numidia city by city, fortify some of them, marching east and west. The African Jugurtha deceived them, embarrassed them, until he was captured in 105 BCE. Trump does not have 8 years to invest. Assassination. Assassinating leaders of other countries went out of fashion many years ago. It may be good to occasionally return to this practice. The Iranians, according to certain reports, plotted to kill President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu. This makes the assassination of Khamenei an almost obvious move. However, Khamenei is not Hezbollah's Hassan Nasrallah, and certainly not an African Jugurtha. Behind him is a relatively orderly state with institutions and a command structure, or so it seems. So we return to the fundamental difference between the American and French revolutions. An assassination of an American president, a William McKinley or a John Kennedy, shocks the nation but does not bring about regime change. The capture and exile of Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte, or the execution of fascist Italy's Il Duce, Benito Mussolini, does. Hence, the question regarding Iran is whether radical Iran is more like the America of the Constitution's authors or the France of the revolutionaries. Is eliminating the leadership in Iran equivalent to regime change? Because without Adolf Hitler there is no World War II, and it's a pity the world didn't realize this and eliminate him in time? Or is hitting the leader merely a disruption to the state system that continues to operate in a similar manner? Of course, not every country fits neatly into these two categories. Revolutionary Iran is externally as aggressive as Napoleonic France. It also wants to change the world and does not hesitate to use force to do so. But regarding internal policy, Iran is likely not dependent on one man as Napoleonic France was, or perhaps it is. It would be encouraging to find out that it is. Trump's USA is not dependent on Trump as Napoleonic France was on Napoleon, and Netanyahu's Israel is not dependent on Netanyahu as Mussolini's Italy was on him. But in both countries, there are signs of a shift from reliance on state institutions to the glorification of individual leaders. This is the essence of the terms, Trumpists and Beebists. The state and the party erode, what remains is the rage and the leader. Success in the war against Iran, which every American and Israeli should hope for, will only strengthen the tendency of both leaders to highlight their dominant personalities as the state axis, at the expense of the boring institutions that serve them. These are the institutions where the engineers build missiles, the chemists manufacture explosives, and intelligence analysts learn the enemy's habits. These officials were there before, they are the people of routine. Above them is the change-making leader. When he is there, change comes. When he is gone, there's only routine. Bibi and Churchill, a tendency to compare Netanyahu to Winston Churchill has strengthened recently among his supporters. Is Netanyahu similar to Churchill? Beyond the obvious statement that it is too early to declare victory and crown a victorious leader, and make Trump an FDR, a leader he might not want to resemble, here are some other points to ponder. Like Churchill, Netanyahu failed and caused a catastrophe resulting in thousands of deaths, Churchill with the Gallipoli campaign, Netanyahu with the policies leading to October 7, 2023. Like Churchill, Netanyahu did not let past failure prevent future achievements. However, there is a difference. Churchill did not continue his career uninterrupted immediately after Gallipoli. He was condemned, pushed out, and only later returned to the top. Netanyahu has been with us the whole way. Like Churchill, Netanyahu led the country through a long war, sometimes insisting on his desired policies despite skeptics, and may be able to declare victory at the end. However, there is a difference. Churchill excelled at raising morale and national cohesion. Netanyahu has not. Even during the war, he is perceived by most of the public as continuing to engage in daily petty politics. Like Churchill, Netanyahu remained in place throughout the war. But will he, like Churchill, be sent to the opposition immediately after the war ends? Churchill lost the election during the Potsdam Conference and was replaced by Clement Attlee. Now let's forget the Churchill analogy and ask seriously. How much credit will Netanyahu deserve if regime change occurs in Iran? The answer is, a great deal. Such an achievement would justify regarding him as a world-class leader who brought about a historic move. It is doubtful others would have led such a move as he did. On the Iranian front, Netanyahu would be a leader head and shoulders above all others. On the other hand, yes, life is never one-dimensional. Such an achievement will not cancel out his failure as a leader of Israeli society, which fell into a deep abyss of division during his time. In a recent JPPI survey, Israelis ranked the social situation as a greater threat to Israel than Iran. On election day, Israelis will have to decide if Netanyahu's achievements outweigh his failures. Reconstruction, circling back to where we started, the raging war and its objectives. Removing an existential threat is one thing, but does that mandate the removal of the terror regime itself, as Netanyahu vowed to do? Or is there a scenario where the regime remains in power, provided it is guaranteed to no longer threaten Israel or the world? Netanyahu offered only a half answer. The operation would provide the Iranian people an opportunity to rid themselves of their oppressors. In short, we remove the threat of external harassment for us and the rest of the world. They remove the internal reality of harassment by the regime for themselves. Of course, such presentation of Israel's objectives hides an unproven assumption that if the brave Iranian people take control, Iran will naturally cease to be an existential threat or abandon its nuclear ambitions. This is logical, perhaps even likely, but it is far from guaranteed. History is full of countries that sought nuclear weapons without being terror regimes, and many nations have chosen to threaten the global order under governments their own people supported, or even elected. In short, Iran can be an external threat under a different regime, so for Israel and the U.S., the elimination of the external threat supersedes the elimination of a specific regime. Still, amid diverse objectives, a clear hierarchy of outcomes can be laid out while the war is still ongoing, and as I write this column, that's still the case. Full success would be a total revolution, overturning decades of Shiite rule and putting Iran on an entirely new trajectory. The maximalist Trump-Netanyahu dream is an Iran that looks like Belgium or Canada, a peace-loving democracy. The realistic view must be grimmer. Look around the Middle East and pick a viable model. Western-style democracies are rare in this neighborhood. Expecting one to bloom in Tehran might be a bridge too far. Medium success would involve a regime that changes its external policies while remaining the same theocratic dictatorship internally. Iran would stay Iran to its own citizens but cease being Iran to its neighbors. The Islamic Revolution would no longer be an export product, but a domestic one. In this scenario, Tehran stops sponsoring terror, stops undermining regional rivals and stops its nuclear drive, behaving like any other mid-sized power that, while perhaps not a political ideal worth imitating, is no longer a threat to world peace. Minimal success would result in a mowing the grass strategy. This entails a severe blow to Iran's military infrastructure, rolling back its subversive capabilities by several years and shattering its sense of invulnerability. Such a strike would allow the U.S. or Israel to pivot back and hit again whenever the regime tries to rebuild. But like all grass cutting, it requires constant maintenance. A return to complacent routine is usually how lethal surprises begin. These three tiers of success represent the potential outcomes planners are currently pitching to leadership. Their realization depends on three variables: operational success, political patience, and the reaction of the Iranian people. The opening moves suggest the operational box is being checked. However, they also reveal a predictable gap between the political patience of Trump and that of Netanyahu, and by extension, between the Israeli public and an American public that remains deeply wary of another foreign war. What the opening moves cannot tell us is how the Iranian public will act. the hardest choice for Trump and Netanyahu will be whether to keep pressing for full success or make do with a medium success when it's already on the table. On one hand, it's usually wise to take the bird in the hand. On the other, stopping short could represent an abandonment, certainly not the first, of the Iranian people. Shmuel Rosner is senior political editor. For more analysis of Israeli and international politics, visit Rosner's domain at jewishjournal.com/rosnersdomain.